From downtown Milwaukee, welcome to Money Talk with Bob Landis. Each week, professional advisors from Landis & Company Investments discuss the latest financial developments, offering timely insight and long-term perspective.
This is Money Talk for Mother's Day weekend. Well, some states are now easing their stay-at-home restrictions, which reminds me that having some states locked down and some states not locked down is kind of like having a peeing section in a swimming pool. Okay, Mother Nature is not the mother we're celebrating this weekend. She's bringing snow and frost all weekend. A couple of TV networks are taking advantage of us while we're under house arrest. ABC is airing the Disney Family Sing-Along with the Muppets. And CBS is bringing back the Sunday night movie. This week, it's Forrest Gump. Puppets and a 25-year-old movie. You decide what you'd like to fall asleep to Sunday night. And the video conferencing platform, Zoom, is the way meetings and social gatherings are done these days. Well, a couple in New York City planned a Zoom wedding. All the guests and the wedding party had to meet just one criteria. They had to wear pants. And if you've ever attended a Zoom meeting, you'll understand. And finally, remember how excited we were when the ice cream truck came to our neighborhood ringing those bells? Well, in Houston, there's an adult ice cream truck in town, and it's put a whole new spin on fudgesicles, popsicles, and paddle pops. This truck is serving up frozen cocktails. I think I just found my summer gig. On today's podcast, we have Kyle Tedding, Dave Sandstrom, and wrapping up the week, here's Bob Landis.
Thanks, Max. We made a few nickels back. NASDAQ down positive territory for the year. That's certainly encouraging. NASDAQ climbed a whopping 6% this week, tacking on 516 points to close today at 91.21. Meanwhile, in the broader markets, S&P stock composite 500 rose 3.5% this week, tacking on 99 points. We closed today with the S&P finishing at 2930. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 2.6% this week, climbing 608 points. We closed at the bell this afternoon in New York, with the Dow finishing the week at 24,331. Total return for the markets now, including dividends, NASDAQ up 2% for the year. The broader markets, S&P 500, down 8.7, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average down 14.1% still year to date. You know, Kyle, let's start off with the jobs report that came out, Labor Department report, of course, this morning, that a little over 20 million jobs were lost in April, far exceeding the total from the financial crisis. Along with that, the unemployment rate shot up to 14.7%. That's the worst since the Depression. Keep in mind that it was 3.5% unemployment just 2 months ago. And now it's up to a whopping 14.7%. I read two conflicting studies. One said that 80% of those unemployed now think that they're going to get called back to work. And another report said that fewer than half will actually get called back. So you see these horrific numbers. But then hope springs eternal when a lot of people think they're going to get called back to work. So we'll just have to see. Kyle, I was also impressed by the fact that the share of the population in the United States right now with a job is the lowest on record. Just 51.3% of Americans have a full-time job right now. So we got room to grow there. Kyle, when you look at the markets, you know, of course, stocks climb a wall of worry. The economic news this week was terrible. Bankruptcies, Neiman Marcus went under. J. Crew started off early in the week going under. A couple major retailers are suggested to be close to declaring bankruptcy. The unemployment reports that came out. But on top of that, stocks kept climbing. I think there's fair amount of enthusiasm still for the stimulus spending and for the optimism of states reopening we've seen a half a dozen states this week starting the process of reopening, and that seemed to excite investors all over.
You know, Bob, I think there's all kinds of noise in the data right now. There's all kinds of reasons to think that, you know, maybe the bad news isn't as bad as what's being reported, and maybe the good news isn't as good on the other side. And I think, you know, you start with some of that labor data and you look at, you know, as you mentioned, more jobs lost in a month than we lost in the financial crisis and the Great Recession. You know, you look at, you know, the number of people who believe they're coming back to work. More than half of the jobs that have been lost, the people that are reporting in on that are saying, yeah, it's just a temporary layoff. When this all blows over, I'll be back to work. And, you know, candidly, maybe that's true. But, you know, as you say, the study out of the University of Chicago potentially showing that, you know, maybe some of those jobs are gone for good. Now, there's obviously a huge drawback to employment there, but that also means that as the economy does recover, something has to happen with that work that was done before, either through increased automation or through some other form of finding sources for that labor, for that work. And so, you know, that can show up as productivity gains, long-term helps the economy. And so, you know, I think you look at some of the drawbacks right now, and the question isn't so much, you know, how bad is it going to get when it gets bad? The question is, what does it look like after? And that's the question that I think we keep trying to answer is, you know, if we make it through without, you know, too much damage, what does normal look like after this? And what does it mean for the retailers that do survive? It's not going to do anything for Neiman Marcus or J. Crew. But then again, those kinds of retailers were already on the way out with the, you know, I think increased online shopping, with the pressure that had been on those businesses for really for years. And so I think you look at kind of all these factors and say, okay, some of the data that's out there continuing to get really bad, obviously. I think some of that data a little bit worse than what many people thought, a little bit worse than what, you know, we've seen in previous environments of crisis, previous environments where, you know, the economy was under duress. And at the same time, you know, you start to see gasoline prices rise as people are filling their tanks again in many states. You start to see, you know, some signs that maybe the travel markets are opening up a little bit, maybe not quite yet for all the leisure travel that people were hoping for the summer, but signs that, you know, the cruise industry, for example, next year is going to come back a little bit. Yeah, probably too late for 2020, but 2021, maybe you start to see some of that travel come back. And so, you know, I think we're starting to see a picture emerge of what normal looks like post-crisis. And the challenge we have is that we have to get post-crisis. And so a lot of stuff still has to happen. We need a vaccine. We need better treatments. We need people to continue to kind of practice, you know, the types of physical distancing that have slowed the spread. But again, if we can get through the next few months, the next few quarters, and look to what happens when this gets back to a somewhat of a more normal environment, you know, I think we're starting to see what that picture looks like a little bit.
Dave, let's bring you into the show. You know, it seems to me that the virus has helped to accelerate trends that were already in play prior to the virus coming to the United States, like retail, the demise of the department store was well on its way. The virus just accelerated that. We see that this week with two prominent retailers declaring bankruptcy. We're seeing in other areas of the market. How do you see this playing out over the next couple of years, Dave?
Well, Bob, it's amazing to me the amount of data coming out in just about every sector that is unprecedented at every level. You know, we've never seen anything like this, and not just in the United States, but globally. When you take entire economies and turn them off really almost in a day, we're going to see unemployment numbers and GDP numbers for the second quarter that, I mean, we haven't even come close to ever seeing before. And you bring up a great point about the, you know, something like retail that was, you know, starting to die out. You saw some of those trends occurring, and you get something like this to happen, and it pushes it completely over the edge. You know, on the other side of the coin, we talked today about the NASDAQ getting back to positive numbers this week. Perfect, you know, somebody that's benefiting from something like this, company like Amazon on the growth side, with that speed up and the demise of brick and mortar retail, of course, they're filling a very vital role right now. And you know, you look for some ways, like Kyle said, how do we come out of this positively on the other side? And this could be one of those points in history where we're seeing a large transition to some of these, you know, new ways of life. The idea of being able to order anything and have it, you know, on the computer and have it delivered to your home in a day or two. You know, there were a lot of people that were fighting that. And like you said, they've been forced into this now. And, you know, companies like Amazon are going to see customers now that they really didn't have a chance to get maybe before by choice, were forced into it. And they're going to be customers maybe for life now. So could be a big transition point. I think you're going to see a lot of these places like that are going to pick up some of those jobs that you referenced earlier that are likely not to return in some of those brick and mortar retail stores. And so I think this could be a big pivot point. And it's going to take a little bit of time, but certainly I think we're going to come out on the other side of this, perhaps in some areas even stronger.
You know, Dave, it seems like every forecast I read these days has, you know, a disclaimer, if you will, that it's dependent upon if and when a vaccine arrives on our shores. A while back, I talked to an infectious disease specialist that felt simply that there was too much money involved in discovering a vaccine. He talked about all the consortiums and partnerships that were being formed now. There are a number of human trials currently with the vaccine, four that I'm aware of. So I think you kind of view the future pre-vaccine and post-vaccine. I mean, look at what's going on in Georgia now. They lifted the restrictions and very few people went out. A lot of businesses refuse to open. People have the good common sense of not to go out and about before they get a vaccine for this. So I think a lot of politicians are going to be surprised. You can't force people from their homes. We talked the last podcast about studies that have shown that people really started hunkering down early March, weeks and weeks before any state-ordered shelter-in-place rules that were imposed on all of us. So I'm encouraged by that. I mean, that's the way to flatline the infection rates. You know, of course, infections and deaths continue to climb. If you strip out New York City's experience from the rest of the country, infections and deaths continue to climb. So it's almost counterintuitive, in my opinion, that they're even willing to lift restrictions at this point, when infections and deaths keep climbing. But there's a, you know, silver lining in all this. When the vaccine comes, hopefully it does come, we'll get back to normal pretty quick. Hey, Kyle, let's switch gears here for a minute. We were talking about the NASDAQ being in positive territory. I see Microsoft is up 16% this year. Apple's up 3.5%. Amazon up 28%. It's the first bear market I can ever remember where growth stocks have held up better than any other area of the market. It just doesn't normally happen that way. The growth stocks historically sink like rocks when the markets go down. That's what we saw in the financial crisis. That's what we saw Y2K, to a lesser extent, the crash in 87. So it looks to me like, you know, you see the market down 12%, then you've got growth stocks that are positive, and then now the NASDAQ positive for the year. Seems to me that's the place to make some money these days.
You know, Bob, I think this is a trend that we had been talking about going back a couple of years now about kind of growth's leadership of the market. And, you know, as you said earlier, I think the crisis over the virus causing COVID-19 has maybe accelerated some of those issues. But what we're really seeing is, I think, a lot of the traditional growth names no longer neatly fit that growth description. That if you use some of the simple measures for growth of high PEs, of uncertainty in their earnings in the future, maybe that isn't quite as neat of a fit as it used to be. And on the flip side, maybe some of those traditional value stocks that we thought had pretty stable earnings that we thought were lower PE, maybe those PEs are starting to rise a little bit because the earnings have been disrupted so much. And so, you know, you mentioned Amazon, Netflix, Apple, but if you look at the flip side on the value side of the market, some of the bigger value stocks, energy names, a company like Disney, who's going to see their earnings largely disappear with the park closed now for months, with the cruise business for Disney not returning for a while, If you erase all of those earnings and you factor in that the share price of Disney really hasn't deteriorated enough to reflect those earnings, all of a sudden the PE of Disney looks very much like the PE of Amazon or Netflix did a couple of years ago. And then again, go back to those growth stocks who have had much more stable earnings, who have not seen their earnings erased by the COVID-19 crisis. All of a sudden their PEs, after those stock prices were hurt with everything else, their PEs start to look pretty attractive. And so it's almost amazing to say that Apple or Amazon or Netflix look more like a value stock than the energy names or Disney or some of those other kind of traditional values do. But, you know, I think it is fair to say right now, at least, that many of those names look more like value than traditional value stocks do. And of course, the other part of that conversation is that, you know, if we usually see value stocks doing better in this type of environment, well, lo and behold, those stocks are doing better. And so I think we have an explanation now for why. For a long time, it was, okay, there's a couple of different reasons why we think growth stocks are leading. And I think that the actual answer is that those growth stocks have finally matured to a point where we can count on them in our portfolios. They finally matured to a place where we don't have to question where next quarter's earnings come from, which I think was a big deal for a long time when Facebook first went public, or when a lot of these businesses first emerged, where they were just spending a ton of money and they weren't making all that much in terms of earnings. Well, now you see Amazon raking it in. You see Apple, obviously, with huge piles of cash. There aren't questions anymore about how they do. We have a lot of talks about growth and value. I think the other conversation is kind of the larger companies versus the smaller companies. And we have so many small businesses right now struggling. You've got essentially 40% of the Russell 2000 businesses that don't have enough cash on hand to survive a month of expenses. And so, you know, you look at Amazon or Apple or Netflix, there's a lot of small businesses out there that are going to be under distress over the next few months. I wouldn't be surprised if we see that some of those businesses get snapped up at pretty decent prices. And then you look at, okay, what does that mean for those bigger companies long term? It means they're even more profitable than we thought because they got a great deal on a good company. It means they're a little more stable than we thought because they're diversifying themselves. And so, you know, I think we're in kind of a new environment where we're going to see some increased stability in the names that have done so well. And I think it explains a lot of kind of that growth value story.
You know, when it starts flooding out, you head to higher ground. That's the expression on the street. In the middle of a bear market, you don't worry about the large caps being able to survive the downturn. You certainly worry about the small caps being able to survive. On a related note, of the 30 million small businesses in the United States, they expect 40% of them to disappear. It's a big number. Let me help you with the math there. That's 12 million small businesses that they don't expect to be around by the end of the year. Dave, let's go overseas here for a minute. You know, I'm struck by the fact that the global markets, ex-US, are down 20% so far this year, give or take. And the U.S. market down less than 10%. The strength of the dollar hasn't helped overseas investors. The dollar continues to strengthen. But, you know, I'm getting the sense that there's some bigger problems going on overseas here with a huge disparity in performance. And, you know, this is on the heels of a number of years of U.S. stocks dominating the global markets. I mentioned just a little bit ago that the virus seems to be accelerating trends that were already in place. And here's another example of international stocks continuing to lag the U.S. stocks by more than a 10% margin. That's a lot in this business. Deb, what do you think?
Bob, you're right on. And I was just going to say that I think you can just use your brick and mortar retail example with that, because some of those trends were in place. You know, still there was a lot of disruption going on prior to the COVID pandemic globally. You know, we had still had Brexit on the table, a lot of things going on there. You know, some of the international markets still struggling to play catch up. It seems like since the financial crisis, the international markets have been just lagging the U.S. market by a number of years and have really struggled to close that gap. And like you said, I think those trends were we're continuing, and then this is just it's like putting gas on the fire, so to speak, to accelerate those differences. I think there's a strong potential we come out on the other side of this thing, and the U.S. is probably going to maybe pick up expand that gap even further on the performance side.
Dave, you probably saw the other day the European officials are now predicting a Eurozone recession of, I quote, historic proportions. So you think about how quickly that materialized, literally in a couple of months, almost without precedent. Kyle, let's talk finally about earnings. You know, I can't remember the last time I've seen such a huge spread in what companies are forecasting now. And it almost seems like we're in the area of issues that are unknowable.
Yeah, you know, Bob, I think you look at kind of the first quarter as, okay, most of the quarter we got through without too much impact of the virus. And then you look at kind of what, as you say, companies are forecasting for the quarters ahead. And I think it's more of, okay, here's our forecast if this, and this happen. And here's our forecast if it doesn't. And, you know, unfortunately, so many companies removing guidance or have long ago removed guidance of those that still gave it. And I think that, you know, the real challenge here is that when you look at the typical measures of value or the typical measures of valuation, things like price to earnings ratio, price to sales, price to book, it's so difficult now to really get a gauge for where those things are heading because everything is based on three or four conditions. And all those conditions right now are still so high up in the air that we really just don't know. And so, you know, I think you look at an earnings forecast that, you know, counts on a forward PE multiple somewhere around 21 or 22 right now for the S&P 500. But again, that counts on us getting back to some semblance of normal later on this year, and then earnings growth really returning in the first quarter of next year. And I think the reality is if we push the vaccine back a quarter or we see a second wave of cases and additional lockdowns later in the year, you know, I think you see that number keep coming down. Now, again, that's pretty typical for earnings numbers to come down ahead of earnings season and then the actual companies to beat those estimates. We've already seen it in the first quarter for first quarter earnings. You've seen 68% of companies in the first quarter beat their earnings, 52% of them beating on the sales numbers. So, you know, not unusual to see that. But at the same time, you know, I think it's just so dependent upon where we end up that ultimately, you know, when we're making decisions about where to invest right now, it's not based on what do earnings look like over the next year. It's which companies do we think survive long enough to get through however long this lasts, because it could be, another 6 months, or it could be another year and a half or two. And so you need to find companies that can get you through that year and a half or two with pretty meaningfully reduced earnings so that they're still around to capture whatever normal looks like when it comes back.
Dave, as you know, the president signed the CARE Act a little bit ago that suspends required minimum withdrawals for a lot of folks for this calendar year, and dozens and dozens and dozens of conversations with clients. Just about everybody I'm talking to is suspending their required minimum withdrawals, trying to take money from other places. Pretty unique opportunity to save money on income tax. People are looking at the proverbial gift horse in the mouth there. David, what are you telling people?
Bob, I agree. If you're in a situation, especially as a retiree, where you aren't forced to use that money for living expenses, it's a great opportunity, especially if you're in a position where you're living primarily off your Social Security and you might have large IRAs in place. You could even get an added benefit there of avoiding additional taxation on those Social Security benefits if that works out that way, and by taking a year off of the required distribution. It should also be known too, though, that I have had conversations quite a bit with clients about not necessarily changing their charitable giving through their qualified charitable distributions, because that still stays off your tax return. So that won't impact your taxes, but you can still take those QCDs and then let the rest of the balance of your RMD lapse for next year. So don't be confused and think that if you're going to suspend your required minimum distribution that you can't make your your charity distributions as well.
Dave, the great thing about that is that it lowers your IRA balance for next year potentially as well. So it lowers your required distribution from where it otherwise would be. And of course, the benefit to the charity at a time when they desperately are needing it. So I think that's a great piece of advice is if you have those QCDs in place, there's no sense disrupting them unless you really feel like you have to.
Well, folks, that's the end of yet another Money Talk. We enjoyed doing the show. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next week.
Thank you for listening to Money Talk with Bob Landis. If you have a financial question you want answered on next week's show, email it to moneytalk@landis.com. To keep informed throughout the week, visit our Money Talk page at landis.com.